Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Johns Hopkins announced last week an initiative to build, hire, and buy in Baltimore, particularly in the areas most affected by the violence following the death of Freddie Gray. At Morgan State University, they formed a task force called Gray Days, Brighter Tomorrows. Catchy names, but will it work? Morgan State's Ray Wimbush and Natalie Sherman from the Baltimore Sun explain two approaches to some of Baltimore's most intractable problems. And The Scoop on the Stoop. The Stoop storytelling series begins its 10th season tonight. We'll check in with The Stoop's creators, Jessica Henkin and Laura Wexler. Plus, a new exhibition at Gallery CA. The subjects are African-American men and the stories they're telling at the barbershop. And Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. It all starts right after the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall here this morning with Nathan Sterner. We are delighted you're with us as well. We begin this morning with a conversation about what two of Maryland's leading institutions are doing to address the longstanding problems in the struggling neighborhoods that bore the brunt of the violence during the riots last April. At the core of the Baltimore uprising is the fact that so many residents in neighborhoods like Penn North and Sandtown Winchester are unemployed or underemployed, with meager prospects for positions that pay a living wage. In August, Morgan State University President David Wilson announced the formation of a task force called Gray Days, Brighter Tomorrows. And last week, Johns Hopkins University and the Johns Hopkins Health System announced an initiative that they're calling Hopkins Local. Both are attempts to address a wide range of problems that have afflicted some of Baltimore's neighborhoods for decades. Dr. Ray Wimbush joins us in the studio. He's the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State, and he serves on the Morgan Task Force. Natalie Sherman is here as well. She writes about real estate and economic development for the Baltimore Sun. She wrote a piece about the Hopkins Initiative last Wednesday, and welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
How you doing, Tom?
So, Dr. Wimbush, what's the charge of the task force at Morgan?
Well, you know, Morgan has always been involved with the community across the board. We're just intensifying a lot of the efforts that we already have in place. We just completed, for example, a major study on our Cherry Hill community. Some people are saying it's the most comprehensive study. And what we're trying to do is involve ourselves more in Sandtown, Winchester. We just received a grant that will allow us to be there for a couple of years. The other thing I think is very important is that we're looking at this as a systemic issue, some of the things that are going on in Baltimore. It's not just about jobs, but it's about education. We've got people on the task force in the public health sector, a variety of things.
So when you say you're going to be in Sandtown, West Winchester for a couple of years, for example, under the auspices of this grant, what does that mean?
Well, it means that literally we are going to be talking to residents. We're not going to just talk to a bunch of talking heads to talk about Sandtown, Winchester, but actual residents. We hope to interview some police officers that patrol in that area in the 5th District and so forth. So it's going to be a continued involvement of Morgan State in that area, but just a little more intense.
And the makeup of the task force doesn't include just faculty. It's not scholars like yourself. It's
students, SGA president. We want to hear from students. And we talked at our last first meeting last week, in fact, about involving residents themselves.
Natalie Sherman, you wrote about the Hopkins Local Initiative last week. What are the parameters of what they described at that press conference?
So I think for Hopkins, it was very much about using its sort of leadership and position and role as the city's largest employer in getting jobs. And so it sort of laid out three parameters, three areas that it was focusing on. One was building, one is buying, and one is hiring. And for all of those, they set specific targets that they're trying to meet. The idea is to distribute the business among minority, women, disadvantaged local businesses.
Mm-hmm. And they talked about maybe getting as much as 17% of the construction business that they proffer each year directed towards minority and small businesses.
Yeah, and they've said that they want to do it very targeted. So they're looking specifically at $135 million of construction services that they think they can take 17% of that. So they overall do about 500 million, 400 to 500 million, I think, a year.
So when they talk about build, hire, and buy, the hire part, is this construction stuff part of that deal, or are they also talking about actual jobs in the Hopkins framework?
It's both. In the Hopkins framework, there are about 432, roughly, entry-level positions every year that they hire. And they think that's where they want to increase some of this participation. In the building and the contracting, there would also be provisions with the firms that they're working with, and then they would penalize those firms, and that's new. Hmm. That hasn't been built into those contracts before.
So they penalize the firms if they don't use the services of people from Sandtown, people from specific neighborhoods, or
that's for the firms, not necessarily the specific neighborhoods. The direct Hopkins hiring would be the specific neighborhoods.
Uh-huh. And when they talk about buying, build, hire, and buy. What are they talking about buying and from whom?
I mean, I think you should think we're having a faculty lunch and we're going to get some catering services. It's things like that. And so the idea would be to get that more of that into local businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday afternoon, one of our producers, Connor Graham, spoke with Elaine Carroll. She's the director of a relatively new organization that's come to Baltimore recently. It's called the Jane Addams Resource Corporation. They're based in Chicago. They're doing job training for people in Park Heights, and they're training in areas like welding and manufacturing, that kind of stuff. Here's what she had to say about the work that they're doing.
So our model operates on a few practices that we really think makes this a well-oiled machine. One is that we simulate the work environment. So the training program itself actually looks like a manufacturing plant. We also, down to the punch clock, have people punching in and punching out. Our instructors in the welding and CNC program really emulate the shop foreman. And then those trainees that are moving into more leadership roles will, be promoted to a shift manager position. So it's really simulating that chain of command. Folks are learning how the chain of command works in the manufacturing culture. But not only that, the other part of that is just holding high accountability and making sure that we're running a program that simulates the work environment in the effect that when they get out there, they're understanding that there are certain things that are expected in those trades.
So Ray Wimbush, is this kind of holistic approach necessary when Hopkins talks about hiring folks for some of the entry-level jobs they have at Hopkins? If it's a person who's been incarcerated, if it's a person who has not spent much time in the workforce, is it enough to give that person a job, or is it also going to take these other steps that the folks over in Park Heights are doing?
Well, I think it has to be holistic, and I think unfortunately a lot of programs don't view challenges in Baltimore as being holistic. I mean, I was talking to a brother in Sandtown Winchester last week, and he said to me, I got job training, but I don't have a job. It's like those things need to be linked. I think the wraparound model is something that's more in theory than in practice. When we talk about dealing with issues that are very indigenous to certain areas of Baltimore.
Natalie Sherman, in the piece you wrote about Hopkins last week, Ron Daniels, the president of Hopkins, said, quote, "This is an effort to demonstrate that we are listening to what we've been hearing," unquote. What have they been hearing?
I think that they've probably been, what he said on the call and what I think we've all heard as well, is that there's frustration in the community that Hopkins' wealth and power has not sort of seemed to spill over in ways that people would want it to. Hopkins is the largest employer, but there's a sense that they're sort of a city on a hill and not benefiting the neighborhood around them. So I think he has really tried. You hear the ads on YPR, and he's really tried in other ways to change that view for altruistic reasons and for selfish reasons. It's part of Hopkins' success.
Mm-hmm. I want to add that we invited President Daniels as well as Ron Peterson, the head of Hopkins Medicine, on the show. They were not available this morning. Ray Wimbush, you mentioned that what you're doing with this task force is really a continuation of the work that Morgan's been doing for a long time. But, very specifically, can Morgan provide jobs for certain people? Can Morgan provide training? Can Morgan as an institution be a place where people can go to be lifted out?
Well, the answer to that, of course, is yes. I think what we do at Morgan is to take those who a lot of institutions reject. 34% of black folk in this state, you know, graduate from high school. And what we have to do is to educate people who have had educational abuse from K through 12. And I think we do a good job of it. I think what we are also trying to do is connect with the work that we're going to be doing in this task force with policymakers. Because in the final analysis, you know, Tom, a lot of this stuff has to do with the will of people who can really make changes in the city. We know, really, I've always said in the research that I do that there's nothing new about dealing with African-American issues of poverty and so forth. What the problem is trying to get people to actually implement some of the things that we put on the shelves after we do the study.
Yeah, so it's going to take some cooperation with state legislature. And Natalie Sherman, on a call that Hopkins had last week, also before this, earlier in the month, Hopkins and other hospitals announced an initiative to create 1,000 jobs. This is places like Mercy Hospital and MedStar, Union Memorial. And they say that program will require some modest changes to existing state regulations. Now, we should be clear that that's a different thing than what we're talking about with Hopkins Local. But in general, did Hopkins say, you know, this is something we can do on our own? We're happy and willing to go it alone? Or is it going to take a lot of cooperation in terms of changing laws or providing funding?
For the 1,000 jobs or for Hopkins Local?
No, for Hopkins Local.
Hopkins Local, they definitely felt like they could do it. It seemed had done a lot of research, making sure that they were within legal barrier rights and comparing themselves to other programs. And they definitely said that it was something they were committed to and that they hoped other places would follow suit.
And Ray Wimbush, just as we finish up here quickly, are there examples of other places that you know of? I know you've spent a lot of time in Chicago, went to school at the University of Chicago. Are there examples where big institutions like Morgan, like Hopkins, can really help the surrounding communities?
Well, I'm biased because I went to the University of Chicago and lived in Hyde Park, but I think it's probably one of the better examples of cooperation between universities and communities in the nation.
Dr. Ray Wimbush is the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University and a member of the university's Gray Days, Brighter Tomorrows Task Force. Natalie Sherman is the real estate reporter for the Baltimore Sun. She writes the Real Estate Wonk blog on BaltimoreSun.com. Thanks so much to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got a link to more information on our website, WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. What would you like to see institutions like Morgan State and Hopkins do to improve conditions throughout Baltimore? Send us a tweet at Maryland Morning or drop us an email to mdmorning@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. News is coming up in just a bit, but after that, the stories from The Stoop with the guiding forces behind The Stoop storytelling series. First, here's Mr. Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been, and now I got to where I am. But these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them to. It's true. I was made for.
Let me tell you a story. In 2011, my daughter, Miranda, served in the Jesuit Volunteer Corps in Anchorage, Alaska. Now, unrelated to the work that she was doing in a chronic care facility, she was invited to participate in a series called Arctic Entries, where people from Anchorage were asked to tell a personal story in front of an audience. And 7 storytellers then told 7-minute stories. A local band performed, and the money they raised from ticket sales went to a local nonprofit organization. Now, the idea for Arctic Entries originated in Baltimore. 10 years ago, Jessica Henkin and Laura Wexler founded the Baltimore Stoop Storytelling Series, and in addition to spawning similar series in places like Alaska, it has become a staple of the performance series and season here in Charm City. Tonight, the Stoop will launch their 10th anniversary Street with a collection of storytellers assembled under the rubric Beginnings and Endings, stories about birth and death, creation and destruction, sparks and flameouts. The curators of these proceedings are Jessica Henkin and Laura Wexler, and they join me today in Studio A. Good morning.
Good morning.
And happy birthday. Oh, 10 years old. That's quite something.
We don't look any older than 11.
10.
You don't. Not at all. So, Laura, this is, I hold the dubious distinction of being one of four people who has never attended a Stoop storytelling.
Yeah, we got to change that.
I know. It's just crazy. The other three people, you know, live in a tent in Leakin Park and never go out.
But we're going to find them.
Yes, we'll find them. But this is a, from what I understand, it's just this funky mix of, you know, theater arts, literary arts, confession, bravery. The setup that I described in Anchorage, I mean, that is, in fact, how you guys do this. Right.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I just talked to those Anchorage, the folks who started that, and storytelling is so big in Alaska. They put their tickets on. They have nothing else to do. Yeah, it's cold. It's cold there, cold and dark. But I mean, I think the thing is that this is such a simple idea, and in its simplicity is the power of it, which is, you know, a person sharing a story about their life. And the way in which people pay attention to this really simple thing is so wonderful. Like, this is it's so different than watching a screen, doing an app, all this stuff. Like, there's this singular focus. There's like a pin drop. It's so quiet in the theater.
And it's really, I mean, this has been 10 years of a mutual admiration society with Baltimore. I mean, Laura and I deeply care about and love this city. And so we feel really honored to be able to give people in Baltimore, regular folks, the opportunity to tell their story in front of a crowd of just loving people.
Yeah. So love is so much
it's,
love.
And it's, and it's just, you know, it's Baltimore based. And you know, we feel just incredibly lucky to be moving to the Senator, which is, you know,
treasure.
Just, yeah, it absolutely is one of our treasures.
So. And of course, Jessica, you and Aaron, your husband, Aaron Henkin, WYPR's
familiar with him. Radio god. Yeah.
You know, storytelling sort of runs in the DNA in your house. But I mean, how did it become a thing with you two guys who've known each other for a long time? All of a sudden, one day you're saying, you know, these stories are so much fun. You get all Mickey Rooney all of a sudden. Say, come on, gang, let's put
on a
show.
We literally describe it as like a one-night stand that turned into a 10-year marriage. We thought we were just going to get together and do this first show, and then, you know, apparently we...
And that was fun, and then let's do something
else. Yeah, so Laura was a writer, and definitely...
Is a writer.
Sorry, is very smart. Very smart. And I had just
Moxie.
Moved back. I had Moxie. I had just moved back to Baltimore to marry Aaron Henkin from New York City. And in New York City, I had studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and had done a lot of improv. And so this seems to be a nice combination of smart writers and goofy, you know, improvisers. So
here's a sample of what happens at the Stoop Storytelling Series. This is Matt Manning. He's a psychiatric nurse who told a story at Stoop about a daughter who brought her mother to the hospital where he was working.
She just seemed pretty normal, except that her dead ghost husband was making, you know, spaghetti every night at 2 a.m. All of a sudden, one night, I think it's the middle of the second week that she was there, her daughter called in a panic. She says, "I need to come in right now." And I said, "Well, it's 9 at night. You know, we can set up a family meeting. We can get a social worker there, talk to you about the treatment plan." She says, "I need to come in right now." Okay, his daughter comes in, and man, she looked terrible. She looked totally frazzled. So we said, "Do you want to go in your mom's room and talk?" She says, no, I need to talk to you alone." I said, "Okay." So we go into a side office, and she begins to explain. She says, "You know, my mother, you know, ever since Dad went, she started collecting things, you know, things started stacking up in her house, newspapers, old boxes of junk. You know, she started hoarding. She never let me touch any of it, you know. She had this organization system, but it was floor to ceiling, boxes, books, and papers. And I figured, you know, she was here. It was the first time she was out of her home for a while. I thought I'd go over there and I'd clean up a bit. So that's what I did, and went to her room, and I tidied that up in the living room and the kitchen, and I went down to the basement and I found this big box of old stuff. stuff from when I was a baby. So I opened it, started looking through, reminiscing. And then I turned my head to the side, and on the floor, I saw my dad sleeping. I know, right? I mean, I don't even know. I mean, probably out loud. I was like, holy shit.
That's Psychiatric News' Mike Manning at the Stoop.
Matt Manning
at the Stoop Storytelling Series. What are the ingredients of a good story? What makes a story good? And obviously, I bet for a lot of the storytellers, when they're on stage in front of a live audience, it comes out differently than they practiced.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and one of the things we have to do is restrain people from writing it out and memorizing it, because an oral story is not a written story. So what makes a good oral story? I think that simple thing of beginning with some version of once upon a time, which could be the other day, or you know, 10 years ago or whatever, signaling that story, which tells us, as listeners, get into that alert state of relaxation that you get into when you're about to hear a story. And then all the listener is doing is saying, yeah, what happens next? Yeah, what happens next? And I mean, in the case of Matt Manning, like, this story is incredible. And it's stranger than fiction. And so that's one of the thrills of telling true stories, is they can be so unbelievable, and yet they're true.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, the emphasis is on true there. And we really urge people to just stand in their truth and stand and just be them, you know, on stage, to be their authentic self. That's why we work really, really hard for them not to, like Laura said, memorize their story, come on with notes or scripts or anything.
And their stories about themselves.
Yeah.
It's not
always,
like they're telling third-person narratives.
We're pretty hard line on that. Like, it has to be about you, and we really want you to be in your story when you're telling it, because for us, the power of Stoop is not about a perfect story. It's not about pretty words or pretty lines. It is about the emotional connection with the listeners, and that's about intimacy and vulnerability.
I just want to point out that you just said Stoop with a Baltimore accent.
I did. Oh my
Stoop.
God.
Stoop.
Huh?
That's the other pleasure of the Stoop, is all the accents, all the Baltimore accents.
And Jessica, you gave a interview to the Baltimore Sun a year or so ago, and you said some general guidelines was, you know,
be
specific,
drunk.
Make it matter, tell the truth, and don't be drunk. I think that could actually, you know, you could use those guidelines for a lot of things besides the Stoop.
I mean, they have gotten me where I am today. I think being specific is also just kind of one of the tools from improv too, as well as truth and comedy. So these things, you know, work really well together.
Let's listen to another story. This is a person named Kim Lee. This is a very touching story about her father, who had fled Vietnam in the Saigon airlift in the 70s. She says that he rarely talks about that particular personal history and communicates with her only on a need-to-know basis. Here's a snippet of her referencing a phone call from her dad.
And he told me about his eldest brother, Tran, who was sent to a re-education camp where he died. And this is the first time I'd ever heard about this uncle. And that day, when the radio announcement happened that the president was surrendering and that the country was over, my dad knew that he had to go. So he grabbed my cousin, and he just ran for the shore, which was 5 miles away. And by the time he got to the harbor, most of the boats had pulled away, but there was this one boat that was still left. But there was this huge line of people waiting to get on, and he knew he couldn't wait, so he picked up my cousin and he put him on his shoulders, and then he just jumped for it. And he grabbed onto this rope that had been dangling off the side of the ship, and he climbed aboard and he made it. And he said that he felt like God or luck had steered him to that exact point at that exact time that day. When he left Vietnam, he not only left behind my mother and my sister, but aside from my cousin, the rest of his family, including his own father, who he would never see again because my grandfather passed away shortly after the war had ended. And my dad didn't say this in so many words over the phone, but I could hear the heaviness in his voice, that this still bothers him.
That's so powerful. And Jessica, what advice do you give to people who are telling an especially intimate story like that?
Well, just to imagine everyone in the audience, you know, naked, that helps. So that they, you know, they can be doubly intimate with those individuals. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, I think it's you just, we work with them. So the process is, you know, we usually get an email from someone or we reach out to them. So Kim was someone that I knew. And then they come and they actually, you know, work with us for a couple of hours and they kind of form a little group amongst themselves, the storytellers, because they're all hearing their stories for the first time. They all know they're
These
about
These are the storytellers that are all going to be on the same bill.
Yeah, they're going to be on the same bill. So in that way, I think we've already kind of, you know, shown them that this is a safe place to tell their story. And then, you know, once they get to the event, like I said at the top, we have been really, really lucky to just get an incredibly warm, intelligent following in Baltimore. So the folks that come to see them are just, they want them to win. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find a heckler at the stoop. You're not going to find, you know, people rolling their eyes and crossing their arms. It's a very loving space for
them. But it is hard. It is hard. As present as Kim is in her story, that's so scary. I mean, it's hard to be emotionally present in your own life, let alone in front of 600 people. So this is costing people something, and the people in the audience know that, and then I think it brings out the best in people.
And both kinds of stories are hard. I mean, the serious ones are hard.
Yeah.
And, of course, being funny is very hard.
Well,
I talk to comedians
all
the time.
And we say no jokes, and we're, like, almost against stand-ups, too, because
the more truthful you are,
the funnier.
The people respond to it.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to this great comedian who does a lot of work in Seattle, Hari Kondabolu, and he actually rents a theater. Comedians talk about this. They hone jokes over periods of months.
Yeah.
You know, so here are people doing it once. You know, and
but that's how
difficult.
This is so different than stand-up, because you're not asking for a laugh. You're sharing. It's not, and people aren't coming with the expectation to laugh or cry or anything. They're just coming for an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, we just say, like, storytellers, you don't have to be perfect. Just really try to be yourself. So it's so fun for us to really push people that way.
Yeah, we'll have a great time tonight. Laura Wexler, Jessica Hankin, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you. Can we just say one thing, which is if you're going to come to the show tonight, please buy your tickets in advance because we only have about 50 tickets left and they will probably 40, go. 46.
46
tickets.
Okay. Now it's 36. Now it's 20. Okay. The Stoop Storytelling Series, they're celebrating their opening of the 10th season tonight at the Senator Theater in Towson. The subject matter is beginnings and endings, stories about birth and death, creation and destruction, sparks and flameouts, drinks and music, rather, by the band Community Center at 7 o'clock. Stories start at 8. We've got a link to the details about the anniversary bash, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later in the program, a conversation with a community artist who takes photographs to help African-American men tell their stories. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more Maryland Morning ahead on 88.1. Stay with us.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. As Baltimore and the rest of the country brace for the trials in the six officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray last spring, the frayed relationship between African-American men and the police is front and center on people's minds. My guest now is Gracie Xavier, a photographer with a background in psychology and social work, who took her lens and her artistic eye to one of the iconic locations in the Black community, the barbershop, where she explored perceptions of Black male identity from the perspective of some of the men themselves and the Culture at Large. An exhibition of the photographs that grew out of that endeavor is at Gallery CA on Oliver Street in Baltimore's Station North Arts and Entertainment District. Gracie Xavier is currently living and working in Detroit, and she joins me on the phone this morning from the Motor City. Good morning. Good to meet you.
Good morning.
So you went
Thank
into
you
a
for having us.
Yeah, sure. So you went into a barbershop and took folks pictures. The barbershop really it plays a central role in your conception of this project, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. For many African American men, the barbershop is held as a very sacred space in which they can be very open and honest and in regards to their relationship with each other and the community. That is a place at which they can bond.
And your work here, the photographs that you took, are an exploration of not only how the culture perceives black men, but how black men are perceiving themselves, right?
Yes, very much so. Because the perception of how the world sees them and how they view themselves is totally different.
I would think it's a very difficult thing to encapsulate, an explication of that those perceptions, both from outside and from within, in a still photograph. How do you approach that project? That's an interesting task.
Well, originally, the project was my attempt. I attended Maryland Institute College of Art and getting my MFA in community art, and I was exploring creating a digital survival guide for black boys. And in doing that, I wanted to collect stories from mothers to their sons. And working with the parents at Muse 360 Arts, the mothers informed me, if you're going to create a digital survival guide for black boys, you actually need to talk to men. So then I approached to several organizations in the community, the Kappa Foundation and Seroma School for Holistic Thoughts, and several schools, and started speaking and collecting stories from those men. But then once I started collecting the stories, I wanted a place where you can get a cross-section of African-American men from different socioeconomic levels. And then the place that came to mind, of course, is the barbershop, where everyone crossed paths. So then I approached New Beginnings at Holland's Market and Reflections Eternal, and I was able to work with those, the clients and the barbers, in regards to not only collecting photographs, but also video interviews.
And what did you find? I mean, there you are. You're a woman in this largely male-dominated culture of the barbershop. Did you have any barriers in that regard to overcome?
No, as a matter of fact, I think they were very open and welcoming in regards to having me come, because one of the biggest issues facing men of color, African American men, is their stories and voice being heard. Often enough, they're spoken about but not spoken to. And someone coming in and then asking first for permission to do a project like this, and then allowing their voices to be heard or their images to be collected and actually giving permission, they were very welcoming to have the opportunity to have a different narrative being told instead of the often one that is often negative and brutal and involve violence, where these gentlemen are fathers, hardworking men contributing in the community, and having that narrative and that story told is a very welcoming opportunity. So therefore, they were very welcoming of me coming into their sacred space.
I think you're exactly right that we're so used to hearing about African-American men and hearing very little from African-American men. When you heard from them, in addition to the frustration that I'm sure they must have voiced about, the lack of access to having a voice in the political and sort of cultural discourse at large, what did they tell you? What did you learn that we're not picking up, we're not learning when we listen to normal media?
Well, one of the most important things that I learned is that the affectionate and the bond and the fraternity that exists between African-American men or men of color. Often when you are looking at the pictures in the media portrayals of black men as violent and stoic, and then you go into this space like the barbershop and you're seeing them having very intimate conversations, laughing, smiling, and learning from each other. That is an aspect that is often not portrayed, that that men of color are contributing and being positive role models in their communities, and that they are present, and that they are active fathers, that they are active mentors, and that they are hardworking. And having those stories told or put on display is a very positive turn to the negative narrative that is often displayed in the media.
You mentioned organizations like Muse 360, which is run by a terrific artist, dance artist named Sharana Christmas. It's a dance program for young kids after school, and these other organizations that you partnered with. Your background at MICA was in community arts, so the work that you're doing really is very much founded in the community, and this is not stuff you're doing by yourself, squirreled away in a little artist's hovel, you know, some studio somewhere.
No, this is very much about engaging the community in a conversation and getting the community buy-in. So it was definitely facilitated by the relationship cultivated at Muse 360 with these parents and working with them in their program like Dancing Many Drums, which is a program teaching young kids about their history, the African diaspora, and then connecting with the parents like Donald Malcolm Smith of the Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity, and therefore then facilitating another relationship with Inseroma Holistic Health Thought. It's all these relationships, all these connections that then made it very easy for me to transition into the barbershop, because those relationships were already cultivated in the community. So they were able to introduce me to those men, and they were very, very welcoming.
Gracie Xavier, the exhibition is called Cuts, Black Men in Focus. It's at Gallery CA on Oliver Street in Baltimore. On Friday night, there's a reception that begins at 6 o'clock, and you can check out the show until October 30th. We've got a link to all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Ms. Xavier, it's been a delight speaking to you. Your photographs are beautiful, and break a leg with this exhibition.
Thank you so much.
That's it for us this morning on Maryland Morning. Coming up Friday, the Baltimore Housing Department is under fire for allegations that some tenants of city housing have been victims of sexual abuse. We'll visit some residents of the Gilmore Homes and talk to a community organizer from that neighborhood for a closer look at what's going on. And Mark Hyman will be here to talk about the future of the Orioles. Lord knows we don't want to talk about the recent past, do we? But we will also talk about the Ravens' status as they enter Week 5 with the game against the Cleveland Browns, and a look into the history of Guilford with the author of a new pictorial history of one of Baltimore's most affluent and storied areas. That's all coming up Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.